This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, May 29th, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. The state of Texas executes Napoleon Beasley, a minor at the time he committed his crime. Seniors from Oregon are driving to Mexico to purchase affordable prescription drugs. And pro-democracy activist in Afghanistan is thrown in jail by a US-backed warlord. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A federal judge has decided to deny John Walker Lynn's attorneys from conducting face-to-face interviews with 19 Guantanamo Bay prisoners who supposedly supplied evidence against him. Gareth Schweitzer reports from D.C.
Judge T.S. Ellis worked out a complex process of interrogation that would require the defense attorneys to submit their questions first to the Pentagon, then to government lawyers, and finally to American intelligence officers who will actually interrogate the detainees. Although the judge based his decision on national security concerns, Mr. Lynn's lawyers claimed that the ruling prevents them from having a due process right to pretrial access to potential witnesses. Georgetown professor David Cole, author of Terrorism and the Constitution, believes that the government is not granting John Walker a fair trial and should revise the charges against him.
If at the end of the day you have a conflict between preserving the national security and giving John Walker Lind a fair trial, it's always open to the government to drop charges against Mr. Lind that it cannot give him a fair trial on.
The government has already acknowledged that information obtained from interviews with prisoners at Guantanamo Bay could be helpful to John Walker Lind's defense. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
The Justice Department said it found no credible evidence that any Florida residents were intentionally denied the right to vote. Mitch Perry reports from Tampa, Florida.
In a letter written by Assistant Attorney General Ralph Boyd, the Justice Department said it looked into 11,000 complaints about the presidential election and found violations in three Florida counties, mostly because of language barriers. Democrats and some civil rights groups say that the inquiry is ignoring the state's controversial purge of voter registration lists, which allegedly denied many minority voters access to the ballot box in November of 2000. Miami State Senator Kendrick Meek says it's foolhardy to expect the Bush Justice Department to fully investigate charges that led their boss to become president.
The campaign is over and the president is the president, but I don't think that the Justice Department is going to come out and say, guess what? We found major issues here in Florida and our guy is not president of the United States, but we feel that it wasn't a fair election. That's just not going to happen.
The NAACP and other civil rights groups filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against the state and several counties over alleged voting abuses in that election. That case is expected to go to trial in August. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
Reports of intelligence sharing between the UN and U.S. are prompting concerns over the United Nations neutrality. Susan Wood reports from the UN.
The Washington Post reports that UN Chief War Crimes Prosecutor Carla Del Ponte last fall provided the U.S. with confidential information on alleged links between Bosnian extremists and international terrorist organizations. Spokesperson Fred Eckhardt says the action was proper.
The Security Council and the General Assembly have both called on all member states to cooperate fully in the fight against terrorism. The United Nations considers that it too has an obligation to assist countries, particularly if a state has been the target of terror activities.
According to the Post, however, some UN officials expressed concern the assistance could solidify the UN's image as a tool of U.S. policy. The organization's reputation was damaged in 1999 by reports that the UN weapons inspection team in Iraq had been infiltrated by U.S. spies. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Today, another federal judge heard arguments from both sides in the case challenging the U.S. Justice Department's refusal to release information about hundreds of people detained since September 11th. Ellen Ratner has more from the Capitol.
Both the government and more than a dozen civil liberties and human rights organizations argued today that the case could be resolved without going to trial, which would expedite a decision. Elliot Mintzberg, Vice President and Legal Director at People for the American Way, one organization involved in challenging government secrecy, was confident that a successful case had been made against secret detentions without going to trial.
We're hopeful that the information in our papers and in the arguments that were presented today in court would be sufficient to show that the government should have to release this information.
Judge Kessler said her decision would come soon, although she declined to give a specific date. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ellen Ratner.
Two U.S. House representatives from Ohio are encouraging that state's school board to include alternatives to evolution as part of the science curriculum. Representatives John Bonner and Steve Chabot cite the recently passed federal education bill as a reason to make sure that schools help students understand the full range of scientific views that exist. Many, including 80 teaching and scientific organizations, say it's a thinly veiled effort to teach the so-called intelligent design theory. That theory says that the intricacies of life are evidence that some guiding intelligence created it. The Ohio School Board will make a determination later this year. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Napoleon Beasley, an African-American man convicted by an all-white jury for killing a white man in an attempted carjacking, was executed last night by the state of Texas. Amnesty International called the execution, quote, cruel and arbitrary, while South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who wrote to the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles petitioning on Beasley's behalf, said, quote, I am astounded that Texas and a few other states in the United States take children from their families and execute them. Spare the child, spare the family, spare the community. From Houston, Ernesto Aguilar has more.
Napoleon Beasley's young life ended Tuesday with his execution by the state of Texas. He was 25. Beasley was convicted 8 years ago at the age of 17. His death sentence renewed debate over the execution of young offenders and again placed focus on capital punishment in Texas, the nation's most active execution state. In his final statement, Beasley apologized for his crime as well as denounced the death penalty. No one wins tonight, Beasley wrote. No one gets closure. No one walks away victorious. Amnesty International, South Africa's Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and the Council of Europe joined organizations from around the world in speaking out against Beasley's sentence. Napoleon Beasley is the 19th U.S. prisoner since 1976 to be executed for a murder committed while under the age of 18, and the 11th such prisoner in Texas. This is Ernesto Aguilar for Free Speech Radio News, reporting from Houston.
With a lethal injection last night, the state of Texas killed its 14th prisoner for this year, for a murder he committed at age 17. The criminal's age at the time of his crime and pleas for clemency from international figures have brought new attention to the United States' use of the death penalty. The U.S. is one of only 22 countries still practicing capital punishment. And the U.S. stands alone with Somalia in executing juvenile offenders. Beasley becomes the 10th child offender to be executed in the USA since 1995. Six of them were killed in Texas. Joshua Chafin reports from Washington.
This was an execution that we really hoped would not take place. Napoleon isn't the kind of person that would qualify for the death penalty under just about anybody's definition.
David Atwood knew Napoleon Beasley's family through his work with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Beasley, who was African-American, was 17 years old at the time of his crime. 33 U.S. states have abandoned the practice of executing those under 18.
What's different about Texas is that we have politicians and we have judges and district attorneys that seem to just bend over backwards to make sure that executions are carried out.
Hoping federal law will soon prevent Texas authorities from executing minors, Atwood supported a stay of execution for Beasley, like the one granted yesterday to Missouri murder convict Christopher Simmons, a white male who, like Napoleon Beasley, was 17 at the time of his crime. Simmons had been scheduled to die by lethal injection next week for throwing a St. Louis woman from a bridge.
And that could have happened in Texas. Our governor could have given Napoleon Beasley at least a 30-day stay.
David Atwood says a 30-day stay from Texas Governor Rick Perry would have been enough time for the U.S. Supreme Court to rule on Atkins versus the state of Virginia, where the court will decide whether it's constitutionally cruel and unusual punishment to execute the mentally retarded. One of the attorneys in the Missouri case, Jennifer Brewer says the Atkins decision might save her client's life.
Chris is not mentally retarded, but the same arguments, the same sort of theory applies to the execution of juvenile offenders. So I think we would have a good shot at then getting a decision from the court that it's also unconstitutional to execute juveniles.
Brewer says, like the mentally retarded, kids are biologically different from adults and should not be punished like adults. The UN Convention on the Rights of the Child forbids the practice of executing minors, but the United States refused to sign the agreement. Richard Dieter with the Death Penalty Information Center in D.C. says if the Supreme Court changes the U.S. stance, it could improve relations with the international community.
We want cooperation from other countries, from our allies, on so many different issues, human rights and terrorism and trade, and we're hurting ourselves by being the last one to abandon this kind of execution.
According to NAACP statistics, there are 82 juvenile offenders on death row in the United States, 28 of them in Texas. Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News.
One of Western Afghanistan's leading intellectuals was released today after being thrown in prison for speaking out against the U.S.-backed warlord that returned to power with the overthrow of the Taliban. Fariba Nawar reports from Herat.
Rafiq Shahi answers incessant phone calls from the press and friends wanting to know what happened to him. He's eager to tell his story. This is the chance for the opposition to warlord Ismail Khan to speak up. Political scientist Shahir, also the president of the Council of Professionals in Herat, a group of intellectuals, criticized Khan's policies at a couple of meetings recently.
In one of my speeches, I've asked people to show courage, express their opinion, and not to wait and ask for the right, and not to be afraid. If they don't, then our society will remain unchanged.
2 days ago, about a dozen men broke into his house at 10:30 at night, climbed over the mud walls, and demanded to see him. When he came out of his house, sleepy in his pajamas, the men blindfolded him and beat him. They asked him random questions about his activities and what he had been saying against the regime. But the men never specified why he was in prison.
Two nights ago, against all human and Islamic rights, about a dozen people entered the house and broke the lock. I got out and told them that I am the one they wanted. They took me out of the city somewhere and then blindfolded and tortured me. Then we went to a basement where they took off the blindfold. I don't know what my crime was, but international and local pressure forced them to release me.
Today, at the request of Afghan leader Hamid Karzai, Shahir was released. Shahir's family were supporters of Khan before he regained control of Herat during the U.S.-led bombing campaign. But now he's among a growing number of critics of Khan, a member of the Northern Alliance who fought alongside Ahmad Shah Massoud for 23 years. Khan won the respect of Afghans, and they welcomed him to rule Herat after the Soviet withdrawal. The Taliban overthrew him in 1995, though. But many Heratis say that he's still a dictator, and they want a democrat. Afghans are impatient for change. Khan has not been cooperative with Karzai's central government, as he has set up his own fiefdom in the West. Heratis say he has employed the same unqualified individuals to government posts, and he still functions as an autocrat. Khan was not available for comment on Wednesday, but he has said in previous interviews that he's taking careful steps to bring change. His promise to pave roads, bring electricity, and allow freedom of expression under moderate Islamic law. To his credit, Herat is the cleanest and most prosperous province in the country. 75% of women are going to school. But as the date for the Loya Jirga, or Grand Council, that will appoint Afghanistan's next government nears, warlords across the country are intimidating opponents who have been elected to be members of the council. 8 people have been killed in suspected connections to the Loya Jirga process so far. Heratis voted for Shahir to be a member in the first round of district elections. The second round is Friday, and he's not sure he'll be on the list of candidates anymore. Another candidate who was ousted out of the process after being elected in the first round is Nur Ahmed Khatibi. Khatibi and about 20 other professionals have been politically active, calling for Khan to reduce his power and cooperate with the central government.
Now we see in Herat that it is a completely militaristic government, and fundamental needs and cultural discussions do not exist. And if they do, it is among people related to Khan, and we're against that.
Khan's opponents concede that he's a logical and often fair man, but not eager to share his power. They're skeptical that the Loya Jirga will loosen his hold on Herat, but they hope perhaps if they keep raising their voices, Khan will listen. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Fariba Nawa in Herat.
As President Bush wraps up his four-nation European tour, he has failed to win widespread support for expanding his so-called war on terrorism, particularly regarding any future attacks on Iraq. Still, the Bush administration is keeping the pressure on its allies while presenting a public appearance of debate within the administration on whether to attack Iraq. At the same time, many Iraqis, including government officials, say they expect U.S. attacks sometime next year. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Jeremy Scahill has the story from Baghdad.
Down, down, Bush! Down, down, Bush! Down, down, Bush!
Down, down, Bush. This chant wasn't written for the current U.S. president. It was the rally cry here against his father during the Gulf War. But with Little Bush, as the Iraqis call him, threatening attack, the chant is making a comeback.
Down, down, Bush! Down, down, Bush! Down, down, Bush!
Iraqis everywhere are well aware of Bush's specific threat to change the regime in Baghdad. But 12 years of deadly economic sanctions and almost constant bombardment have smashed any potential support the administration could hope to win inside the country. Even those Iraqis who quietly speak out against Saddam Hussein say they would never support a change of government brought about by a Washington-orchestrated coup or another massive bombing. With our souls, with our blood, we will defend you, Saddam. In Iraq today, chants like these have taken on a new meaning. They have come to represent not the people's undying love for their president, but a message of defiance against Washington.
Our president is our decision. It's not America's business. America chose Bush. We chose Saddam. We didn't interfere with who you decided for president. We're free. We choose our leadership. Who's Bush to tell us who's good for us and who's not? And he's punishing us because we chose our leader.
The threats are undoubtedly making the government here in Baghdad all the more powerful. Senior officials say they believe the U.S. will attack sometime in the next year, but they say Bush will not succeed in bringing down their government. Dr. Abdul al-Hashimi is an influential member of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party and a former federal minister.
The threat is there. American military activities is on every day in Iraq in the no-fly zones. So one thing we can do, and we know for sure that we can defend Iraq. One thing we know for sure that we can prevent American administration from achieving its objectives in Iraq. That one thing for sure we know. But when the American administration is going to decide to hit Iraq, they will do that. And they will find an excuse for themselves to do that. Nothing we can do about it. But what we can do about it is defending Iraq.
Analysts here in Iraq who monitor U.S. policy very closely say there is little Baghdad can do to avert an all-out attack by the Bush administration, that Washington is rejecting Baghdad's efforts at dialogue, refusing to spell out specifically what it wants from the government.
When you are deaf and blind, you can't see, you can't hear, you can't talk with the American administration, so what can we do?
Political scientist Jassim Zaboom is the director of Baghdad's Mother of All Battles Research Center, which documents the Gulf War.
We are not asking about new things. We are not asking how to compensate Iraq about these damages for a million years, for depleted uranium, for the cancers, for the deaths of children by 1.5 million child within 10 years. We don't ask about this. We can't forget it, but we are not in need to deal with it now. We are just want to let us live freely in harmony with the whole community in the world, but with our sovereignty.
Down, down, Bush! Down, down, Bush! Down, down, Bush! Down, down, Bush!
For Free Speech down, Radio down, News, Bush. This is Jeremy Scahill in Baghdad,
down,
Iraq.
Down,
An estimated 1 in 5 Americans can't afford prescription drugs their doctors say they need. In Oregon, 1 in 3 seniors lack insurance to keep up with the escalating drug costs. Some are forced to choose between food and the medication they need to stay alive. In an effort to demonstrate the crippling costs of pharmaceuticals in the United States, 19 Oregonians flew 2,000 miles from Portland to see if they could find affordable drugs in Mexico. Rob Manning followed the seniors south of the border and files this report.
Just a few moments, we'll begin our pre-boarding for the flight, so if you do need a little extra time or assistance.
Two planes, a trolley, and two buses later, nearly two dozen Oregonians walked into a bustling pharmacy in the heart of Tijuana's tourist district. These Oregonians didn't come all the way to a Mexican border town to smuggle illegal drugs or buy blankets. They came for American-manufactured pharmaceuticals they'd heard they could find cheaper in Mexico. Mary Beth Healy is with Oregonians for Health Security, the sponsors of the so-called Senior Spring Break.
And what we have found, indeed, is that Oregonians feel that there is a crisis in health care, and certainly that the health care system is not serving us well. And we are taking this trip to Mexico to illustrate the need for prescription drug reform in Oregon. And our goal is really to put a human face on the alarming statistics, like 1 in 5 Oregonians lack any prescription drug coverage. That is an outrage in the United States.
Bonnie Bauer, a union home care worker, is allergic to the sun and has seen the cost of her medication steadily rise and her options diminish. But even though she works in home care, Bauer doesn't have health insurance and makes too much money to be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan, the state-sponsored system for the poorest of the poor.
The reason I'm here is, of course, to get medication. But I want to see how much trouble it is, how much of a savings it is, and what exactly you can get. I'm really curious because 2 years ago they discontinued a drug that I've taken for 20 years. Yeah, trisoralin. And to get my $500 a month drugs, too.
Bonnie Bauer made out well. Bauer was looking for drugs to treat her sun allergy and found a great deal on skin medication oxorolin. She bought it and a handful of others, somewhat out of fear the cost of her skin medicine would go up if she dropped the other medications. Al Barnes, a retired draftsman, flew with his wife Roberta. Together they were struggling to pay for a half dozen medications that cost $10,000 a year. They found almost everything they were looking for at a fraction of the cost.
For the particular medications that I need, it looked like there's about 20 to 30% of what I'm paying here for the same thing down there. And it makes a big difference. I made a killing on it, really. $533 for every 3 months. And I could get the same thing down there for $91.
But not everyone came away happy. Retired Salem police officer Jim Byrons was looking for three relatively new medications, including Wellbutrin, Viagra, and Prevacet. But he found the Mexican prices couldn't beat the $250 a month he paid in Oregon. Jim Byrons.
The Wellbutrin was more expensive here than it was at Bi-Mart in Salem, Oregon. And the Prevacet was only about $3 saving, so it wasn't cost-effective to buy any. And the Viagra, he just flat told me when I said I was wanted Viagra, he says, buy it in the United States. I can't touch their price. And it was 15-something for a tablet. And then through prescription, it's about $9 and something in Oregon. So no, I did not.
The pharmacy owner says most drugstores in Tijuana will give at least a 15 to 20% discount. The Pharmaceutical Researchers and Manufacturers Association says Americans may be taking their lives into their own hands by purchasing drugs in Mexico. Reports of reactions to counterfeit drugs have been rare, even as the number of people crossing into Mexico for medicine has gone up. The American Medical Association and the pharmaceutical industry have tried to discourage Americans from buying drugs in Mexico on health grounds, but even their studies find less than 5% of Mexican prescription pills are counterfeit. Pharmacist Carlos Cortez says health worries shouldn't be an issue.
We are talking the exact same qualities, the exact same laboratory, with the exact same manufacturing methods. Now, where you may have slight differences in the generics, but what we do is we do testing of all our generics, which we have right here. These are all generics, and we do samplings every so often just to ensure that we have the exact quality and the quantity of the milligrams of the medication or the active substance in the product. There is no problem with quality.
Fly-by-night shoppers from Oregon are not necessarily looking to make Mexico their source for prescription drugs. The bigger purpose of the Tijuana trip was to draw attention to the high cost of drugs in this country. Only a handful of travelers saved enough on their drugs to make the trip pay for itself. But home care worker Nancy Wyatt says that's not why they went.
So I'm right along with everybody else. We need to get something done here. Whether it be a co-op going with other states or whatever, it's just tremendously too high. And there's some people that are dying because they cannot get their prescriptions. And they don't can't even go to the hospital because the emergency is so outrageously high. So we've got to do something. And if we have to go to Canada, we will.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rob Manning in Portland, Oregon.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York City, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz, headlines editor Randy Zimmerman, technical producer Jade Paget-Seekins. We had web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. I'm Deepa Fernandez.
I'm Joshua Chaffin in Washington, D.C. I've reported for Free Speech Radio News from California and Brazil. Now I'm on Capitol Hill. I work for Free Speech Radio News because it's the only place that lets me give an honest account of what's happening in the news. But Free Speech Radio News only stays on the air with your financial support. Please make a donation online at fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. Or call 510-287-5551. That's 510-287-5551. Thank you for your support.